The Colorado Catholic Herald is now on Twitter. The Colorado Catholic Herald, your primary source of news and events from around the diocese, is now on the social media platform of Twitter. Get advance notice of upcoming headlines, breaking news, and special event coverage. Our handle is the @ CCHERALD. That's @CCHerald. So join us on Twitter.
Welcome to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a weekly roundtable discussion of events and issues facing the church and culture today. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Diocese of Colorado Springs and the Catholic Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
Welcome, friends. Thank you for joining us. This is Bishop Michael Sheridan. And today I am visiting with Dr. Michael O'Donnell. Michael is no stranger to me. In fact, you didn't even have very far to come for this show from the first from the first floor of the Catholic Pastoral Center to the third floor where our studio is, because Michael is the Vice President of Institutional Advancement and Chief Development Officer for Catholic Charities of Central Colorado, which is our diocesan Catholic charity. So Michael is a colleague right here in the building. Thanks for coming up two floors, Michael.
It is good to be here, Bishop.
But our main topic today is not Catholic Charities, although that's an important one. I've asked you to come and be on the program because of your recently published book, What a Son Needs from His Dad.
That's right.
Very forthright title.
I think everything. So.
But even before that, I want our listeners to know that that you are you do a regular column for our diocesan newspaper, the Colorado Catholic Herald, called Family Matters, mm-hmm. and it's a great column.
It is, and well, hopefully it's helpful.
I think it is helpful. It is helpful.
Whether it's great, I'll leave that to your listening audience to decide.
And I know you're the author of a number of books mm-hmm. and articles already, but this latest one, What a Son Needs from His Dad, published by
Bethany House, right. with Baker Book Publishing.
All right. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your own background,
okay.
and maybe how you came to be interested in and knowledgeable about family matters and family relationships.
Well, initially, you know, when most people think about setting out on a career dealing with families, they think of crisis intervention, remedial, what we call counseling, therapy. And that was really what I was thinking about, is going into counseling originally. Until I met a gentleman with Kansas State University, Ken Kennedy was his name, a professor there, who said to me, "Had you ever thought about looking at prevention through education strategies?" I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" He said, "Well, we know a lot about what's wrong with families, but what about what's right with families? If we were to know what was right with families, couldn't we develop educational curricula that could help families before they even had children or before they even had families to know what a good or strong family looked like?" And I thought that was rather intriguing. And so that led me to an individual by the name of Nick Stanay, who helped pioneer what we call today in the field family strengths research by going out and looking at what's right with families versus what's wrong with them, and then giving those strategies to families so that they can have the same kind of strength, and likewise with the parent-child relationship, which I put into the book, What a Son Needs from His Dad.
You did this research yourself?
I did adolescent wellness research with Nick Stanay, where originally through Reader's Digest, they put out a call for teens that were doing well in families that were doing well. And we had other ways of gleaning these strong teens. And we compiled research and gave them questionnaires to find out what in their environments produced wellness among teens. I mean, you hear about the teen years as being turbulent and, you know, adolescent angst. So we went to look at what's right with teens. So we went on a search for the strong teen in the continental United States in the way that Nix Denay formerly had gone after strong families, with the same goal of let's begin to think about a prevention through education strategy, enrichment versus just counseling.
You know, I haven't done research on this. Is it my imagination? It seems like books that have to do with helping young men grow in their masculinity, mm-hmm. To become good men, good fathers. This is something we see on bookshelves more and more now, don't we?
Much more now than before. When we began in the late 80s, early 90s, looking at a review of the literature, we found that there were over 76,000 citations on mothering. But when you looked equally at fathering, less than 1,700, which suggested that if you were going to blame somebody in the parenting quotient for the ills of teens, you'd blame mom, right? Because you have the most research and books written about her. So we decided there was an inequity and we needed to change that disparity and begin doing the research, the hard experimentally designed, peer-reviewed research on what is the contribution of fathers in the parenting quotient, and even looking at, I did, the impact of fathers on the sex role development of sons and daughters.
Did you go into that research, into that project, pretty well knowing that a father has the most influence on a son, that what the son becomes is going to be primarily dependent upon the kind of father he has?
You know, I probably, all researchers have bias, but I tried to set that aside and go in objectively.
It sounds logical. I mean, it sounds like...
And yeah, you would assume that to be the case, but surprisingly, and for your audience that is male, fathers listening today, to hear that research demonstrates that the more nurturing the father, the more masculine the son. You know, some men are to the contrary. They feel like, well, if I'm affectionate with my son or I'm too available for him, you know, it might mean that he'll grow up effeminate. But the research demonstrates the opposite. We also found that the more nurturing the father, the less sexually promiscuous the daughter. So the impact of fathers on children in terms of well-adjusted children is profound. But we're battling against, there I am, talking. But we're battling against the stereotypical, where dads are seen as disciplinarians of last resort, principal breadwinner, that kind of role, not really seen as the parent, the one who nurtures. And yet research shows that fathers are absolutely necessary.
I know we're not really into the book yet, but I have these questions, and you're sitting in front of me, so you can you could take a stab at them. Is it your sense that there has been a kind of feminization of men, of boys? I've actually heard that said, in particular, about the church. There's kind of a feminization going on. I'm not even sure exactly what that means, nor am I sure that makes any sense to you.
No, it does. I think that we have, the pendulum has swung too far to the feminine and the idea that only women can be upright and moral these days, that men are quite lacking, that only women can do nurturing well, that this characteristic nurturance is uniquely feminine. And that's not true. We know that Jesus was nurturing. We believe that God is nurturing. And so we're going against the stereotypical that would suggest that only women can do this well. And in fact, Margaret Mead, the famed sociologist, said that children need a father like a fish needs a bicycle. And there was the notion that somehow men were redundant in terms of parenting. We didn't really need them. We just needed the mother to produce well-adjusted children. And now the research demonstrates quite to the contrary, that fathers impact the cognition and intellectual development of children, the ability of children in language acquisition, emotional maturity, and sex role development of both sons and daughters.
Why don't you talk a little bit about this book? What a son needs from his dad. I'm sure that's not just one thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
get us into the book.
Yeah, the book was a project whereby we knew that many men wanted to be better dads, but didn't necessarily know how. It's like Christianity, it's not just taught, it's caught. You know, it's modeled. And if you grew up in a home with a distant or detached father, or what they call in the research, phantom father, he's there but not really involved. And in fact, I think when I was looking at the research just recently, 37 seconds a day is what a father spends in meaningful interaction with his children.
37 seconds.
37, yes, you heard correctly. And you obviously know that's not going to get the job done. So you have a lot of mom being involved in their lives, very little with regard to dad. So when a father is trying to think about, well, what does a good dad look like, he may not have a resource in relationship to his own father. So I wanted to put a book together that would give men clear, concise examples of what a good father looked like, not only in theory, but through anecdotal information that says if you're looking for a way to be a father, this is what it looks like.
Well, what are some of those things that mark a good father?
Well, you know, we can look at an acronym that became pretty important in the research. I can, we want to say to dads, you can do fathering. And it's involvement, consistency, awareness, and nurturance. You know, you want fathers to be involved. I talk about that. You want them to be caring and aware of what's happening in the life of that child. I talk about that. Awareness, so caring and aware, and then nurturance. A lot of fathers are, well, what does it mean to be nurturing? I know how to throw a football, but I'm not sure other than playing with my child, what does nurturance really look like?
Let's start at the beginning. What is this, what's involved in involvement?
Involved would be that it's not just playing with the child. It's, if need be, feeding the child. It's clothing the child. It's putting the child to bed. We're talking about when the child's young. It's holding the child, comforting the child when the child is upset. It's reading to the child. We have found that it's very significant when fathers read to their children, not just the mother. We find that it's good for the son in terms of language acquisition and cognition, the ability to think well, that when father models these things, they become attractive to the son. The son begins to believe that this is something that ought to be a part of my life, not just being physical, but also being intellectual, being emotional, rational, those kinds of dynamics. But also if a father's involved with church, this speaks loudly to the child. When the father is seen on his knees, you know, unexpectedly, you know, praying because there's a problem in the family. These speak powerfully. In fact, you know, we're trying to say to dads that you may well be the only sermon your son reads. You know, they may not be listening to the priest on Sunday, but they're going to be watching dad. And so dad and what he does may be worth 100 sermons. If you follow me, Bishop.
No, I do.
Yeah.
No, and I, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and as I look back now on on those sitcoms that are still shown from the 50s, you have that stereotype of the 50s father who went to work in the morning, came home in the evening, and sat down and read his paper and ate his dinner, and mother continued to do everything. I think it's been a while since that stereotype has been somewhat set aside. But, you know, I can hear some fathers saying, you know, I work 8 hours, I work 10 hours a day, and then I have to come home and still be a parent.
Right. Right. And what they don't understand is whether they say that or not, it's communicated to their children. Because as soon as they come in from work and the child approaches the father, they quickly learn dad is basically non-verbally communicating, I gave it all at the office. Mm. I have nothing left over for you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, Michael O'Donnell, who is the author of What a Son Needs from His Dad, and we're discussing that book. We will be back after we take this short break.
The Colorado Catholic Herald's blog offers a chance for you to be heard on Catholic issues. Click on the red blog link at coloradocatholicherald.com and join the discussion. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.
Welcome back. With me today is Dr. Michael O'Donnell, who has authored a brand new book, What a Son Needs from His Dad. And we've been talking about that for a while, Michael. We were talking about involvement, how important it is for a father to be involved in the life of his son, of daughters also. And I made reference to what I saw as this kind of 50s stereotype of the father who was the breadwinner. There was no doubt about it. Mother stayed at home. And in fact, that was my family. My mother did not work outside the home from the time that she was married. She raised the kids. My father went to work every day, and some of them were long days. And I remember in the evenings, he was always part of the conversation. I don't think we got our first television until I was almost 10 years old, so that maybe that's what saved me from some of this. But I remember he was always part of the conversation. He was always interested, but I think there was a sense in which, as I look back on it, that my mother ran the home and he brought in the resources for her to do that. And that's I think, what was reflected on television.
Sure, also. Even the commercials, remember, I bring home the bacon, she fries it up in the pan.
That's right.
And never lets me forget I'm a man. Right. I think there was definitely that role differentiation based on sex, but in a way that proved very negative. I mean, yeah, there are things that are uniquely feminine. There are things that are uniquely male. But fathering is definitely to be a part of family life and ought to be something that men embrace as a part of their identity. That part of my growing up and becoming a man is knowing how to be nurturing.
Well, it's hard for me, I guess, to look back on my experience as a child and find fault with my father. I can't find specific faults, but based on what we're talking about, I have this sense that maybe he should have done some things differently.
He wouldn't have known to do it differently.
Oh, because that's what
his dad did.
Exactly.
And that was the expectation of society. And added to principal breadwinner would have been disciplinarian of last resort. Can you think of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, no.
Yeah. He was, wait till your father gets home.
Exactly.
Old,
he was last resort. Yeah,
that's
not,
right.
Not first, yes.
That's right. But we feared that, wait till your father gets home. I remember I'm an identical twin, Your Excellency. So imagine that.
There are two of you.
Yeah, there are two of us, and we walk alike, we talk alike. Remember the Patty Duke show?
I do, yes.
Yeah, so very much our experience. But my dad, when we were very young, preschool, he could not tell us apart. So he would yell, Michael, Richard, come here. Which one are you? And then, we'd aid him in this apparent disability against, our better judgment, because he'd be like, oh, you're Michael, so you did this wrong. So he'd spank me, So I began to realize, Dad can't tell us apart. And my mom would write the name of the disobedient twin on a blackboard, small blackboard by the phone. And he'd come in, he'd read the name. Well, he knew Michael slept on the top bunk. Richard slept on the bottom bunk. So when he came to discipline us, he'd pull us out of the top bunk for Michael, the bottom bunk for Richard. So I had to figure, I'd broken a lamp. My mom told me to stay away. You're getting too close. I was on my tricycle, but I was disobedient. I broke the lamp. My name went up on the infamous blackboard by the phone. So as a preschooler, I began to think, how do I get my twin to occupy the top bunk? Something he previously would never do. He was fearful of heights. And so I thought about, we had that popular show, I'm sure you remember, Superman. The half-hour black and white,
yeah, the original.
faster than a speeding bullet, that whole nine yards. Well, Richard and I were fans of that particular program.
Oh, so was I.
So I began to lean out over my bed, the top bunk. We'd just been put to bed, da-da-da-da-da-dum, faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, go to bed. I'm just having fun up here, Da-da-da. I'm pretending to be the Man of Steel, going over the great metropolis, And he'd be like, well, I'd like to do that. No, this is just for me. I'm on the top bunk. And, you know, and all of a sudden began to plead and beg and let me get on the top bunk, which is what I wanted. And this is a true story.
It's like Tom Sawyer.
This is terrible. I know the psychological damage to this day, but he got on that top bunk. And I could barely contain myself as he continued where I left off. Faster than a speeding bullet? Dun, 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 dun. I don't think so. More powerful than the locomotive? Not, you know. And then, you know, I'm feigning being asleep because I just can't wait for my dad to come home and pull him, the sleeping child, from the top bunk. And I could hear him to this day. That poor brother of mine, Richard, you know, as my dad was like, stand still. No, whack. But I didn't do anything. Stand still. Whack. But I didn't. So the more he protested, right, the more he got spanked. So where were we? What did this have to do with?
Well, we were talking about memories of our childhood.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I think.
Disciplinarian of last resort.
Right, that's right. But as I think, again, back on my childhood, I think one of the things I'm most grateful for, one of the fondest memories I have, is that my grandfather, in this case, my grandfather and grandmother, had a little, I guess you'd call a little cabin sort of thing, house out in the country, not too far from the metropolitan area, maybe an hour's drive. Uh-huh. And during the summer, almost the entire extended cousins, and we'd all go out there and spend the weekend together. So I mean, I guess I'm not talking specifically about my father at this point, but I remember those weekends were wonderful opportunities to come to know and you know,
exactly.
speak to and just my grandparents, my aunts, and of course all the kids that were there too, as well as my. My father.
You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah. I mean, when you go back in time, we were an agrarian society. We all lived on farms. And so daughter shelled peas with mom on the steps with grandmother. And son was out in the fields with father and grandfather. And so values were being spoken of and mores were being modeled. And this is how we learned. And this is what we knew as expectations for when we got older. But when Dad went off to work with industrialization, he was off the farm. We had the consolidated school system. And that's actually the first time we begin to see juvenile delinquency. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Once you went from the agrarian society to an industrialized society and removed father from the parenting quotient, that's the first time you begin to see juvenile delinquency and a whole field grow up to deal with it called social work.
Because in the city, for the first time, Dad was gone.
That's right.
Yeah.
You remove him from that environment, and that's the kind of chaos that ensued.
It is unlikely that we will return to the agrarian, so we need to...
So we have to look at ways to do parenting differently in the 21st century. Yeah. But we have to acknowledge that it cannot, must not be done without Dad.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you gave us that little I Can...
acronym.
Acronym at the
which
beginning.
Was developed, by the way, by Dr. Ken Canfield. Dr. Ken Canfield. So
okay,
you
so it's
go on the internet and Google. He came up with that original acronym, Involvement, consistency, Awareness,
and
Nurturance.
What is – I know what – is nurturance – I've never heard that word. I've heard nurturing, but what is nurturance?
Well, nurturance is really the idea that a father's presence is very, very powerful, that there's something nurturing and comforting to the child to know that the father is just in the next room. We know that when fathers go on extended stay for business away from the family, mothers will tell you after like 48 hours that children are almost uncontrollable, that there's something about Dad just being in the household, which is a form of nurturance for the child. Children sleep better knowing that Dad's just a hoot and a holler away, you know, that it feels safe. They feel like, well, you know, by Dad being in the house with us, then we're less likely to incur the wrath of some violent attacker or whatever. And so it isn't just doing things that are perceived as nurturing, but it's understanding how nurturing just the presence of Father is. His voice in the being heard in the household is nurturing.
I'm a believer in the power, the influence that popular media has. Of course, you're saying even without any kind of media presentation on this, the presence or absence of a father makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
In the family. But it doesn't seem to me that popular media, I'm thinking of television programs. Mm-hmm. I don't watch television that much, but I get a sense that fathers and fatherhood and what that means is not particularly presented in the best of light. Is that your experience?
I think it is. I think it's unfortunate that fathers are held out to be buffoons. You know, basically, we make fun of them in the sitcoms. I mean, they really don't bring a value to the family system. And it really is reflecting what culture thinks of dads. And yet, the research is clear. I mean, it is quantifiable. It tells us that if you remove fathers, if fathers are not engaged with the family, then the children are going to suffer in many ways, not to exclude daughters, that the father helps the daughter understand something about herself. I think I said earlier, Bishop, the more nurturing the father, the less sexually promiscuous the daughter. That's interesting, isn't it?
It is. It is.
So what we have found is that young girls who have detached, distant dads will often get involved in illicit sexual relationships with men, unwanted sexual relationships, because that's part of the bargain. You know, if you're going to get a nurturing relationship with me, a guy, I'm going to want sex, you see. And so they find themselves in these precarious sexual relationships that they don't desire because they're really searching for dad. So if fathers gave their daughters love and a sense of well-being and a sense of confidence in who they are, they would need to go searching for a man that will then unfortunately require something illicit.
You say these TV programs, especially sitcoms, reflect what the culture thinks about fathers.
Right.
Do you think it's trying to promote that image of a father? Are we really, as a society and as a culture, looking to kind of undermine what the family is and what the role of a father is?
I think it's conscious, and I think it's not always deliberate. But there is a feminization. I mean, we can even talk about a feminization of the church, feminization of any ordered group that was primarily male. Now they're saying we have to include females. And so there's the idea that anything exclusively male is bad, that men, by and large, are redundant and unnecessary. And, you know, until we could show hard-nosed research to the contrary, we really didn't have an audience. It began really with the Murphy Brown speech, which, if we need to go, we can come back to it.
Yeah,
the infamous.
Right,
when Dan
Quayle, I remember it vaguely anyway.
Was against Murphy Brown, who on her program, she was touting that I'm going to get pregnant and bear this child independently of a male as a father to this child, and that this would be seen as good.
And Dan Quayle objected to that.
He did. He said, no, nothing could be further from the truth.
And he was held to be what, hopelessly antiquarian about this,
right?
Whole,
and
so
sexist,
out of it, yeah,
and,
sex, yeah,
yeah, and uninformed, and so they went to David Blankenhorn, who had been a graduate of Harvard University in classical liberal track labor relations, and asked him to do research and to look into that as a question: do we really need dads? And he came back and he said, "Well, I don't want to make single-parent, mother-only families feel worse off than they already do, but the research is demonstrating clearly, yes, we do." And until he came out from Harvard saying these things, we really didn't give a listen.
Okay. Well, on that thought, we're going to take another short break, so please hang in there. We will be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Bill Howard, editor of the Colorado Catholic Herald. Let the Catholic community know what's happening at your parish. Email information with a point of contact for upcoming events for a free listing in the diocesan calendar in the Colorado Catholic Herald. Send it to us at least 1 month ahead of the event to marie@coloradocatholicherald.com. That's Marie, M-A-R-I-E, at coloradocatholicherald.com. And now we return to a very special episode of Bishop Sheridan Presents.
We're back with Dr. Michael O'Donnell, who does a monthly column for our Colorado Catholic Herald newspaper here in Colorado Springs called Family Matters, and is the author of a newly released book, What a Son Needs from His Dad. And that's what we've been talking about before this last break, Michael, kind of talking about what effect media has on our on our understanding, our perception, our appreciation of fathers. And you're right. You mentioned the Murphy brother. That thing's got to be 20.
Oh, yeah.
20 years. As I said, I don't watch that much television, but it is commonplace now to see shows, supposedly, you know, prime time sitcoms, where women decide, well, I want a baby. I don't need a man. I don't need a father to raise that baby. Right. I just need a father to make the baby. That may have caused a stir 20 years ago. It's out there now as something to be taken for granted, don't you think?
I think so, but we're beginning to see some change, especially in the textbooks. They're beginning to acknowledge that fathers are an indispensable part of the
equation. Oh, in the textbooks, great.
In the textbook, yeah. But in popular culture, though, you're talking
about.
Well,
yeah, let me tell you
so
this.
It hasn't
I'm
going to
do
up.
One more TV thing.
Yeah.
One of the things, if you watch a TV program, you can't avoid are the commercials. Well, I guess you could. I think you could walk away, but
we try.
I have found, at least it's made an impression on me. Maybe it's not out there as much as I think it is, but I have noticed now commercials. I don't even know what they're selling, but you know what they're showing? Fathers and sons.
Yes.
Whether they're eating a cookie or a bowl of cereal, it's a father, and sometimes it's a grandfather and his son. But a little child, right. Usually a male child, with an older male figure who's either the father or the grand. And I thought, what? Now, commercials obviously are supposed to grab you at an emotional level.
Exactly.
So somebody's thinking showing this kind of a relationship.
Right.
Is
it's
important.
Madison Avenue, and of course they don't give a rip about fathers being involved in the lives of their sons, but they know that their market, they're predominantly women, and the women who are looking for...
So this is addressed to women.
Oh, yes. Women.
And women want to see that kind of relationship.
They do, and it's like the man who uses as a hustle, he'll get a puppy. You know, and he'll sit out in the park with the puppy and all the girls will come up. Look at the puppy. You know, and it's really just a hustle, you know. He doesn't even own the puppy. He borrowed it from a friend. But, you know, it's almost like that, you know, that somehow it's fashionable to be photographed with a young male and I as the father because it's attractive to women who want what they didn't get. They want a reversal of that. They want now a husband.
This is complicated.
It is complicated, isn't it? They want a father, you know, a husband who will be a father to their son. Yeah.
So often the very women who standing on some platform of feminism and kind of want to reject the necessity of a male, of a man in their life, nevertheless are attracted by that.
You know, it's so interesting that you bring that up because I would make a distinction because I don't think that Catholicism is anti-feminist.
Not at all.
But I think we're talking about militant feminism.
Yes.
Yes.
Ideological feminism.
Right. And so when I would go out and do speaking on the impact of fathers on the sex role development of sons and daughters, it was amazing how the militant feminist many of them would come up to me and say, you know, I think you're right. I think that some of my angst is because of what I didn't get from my dad.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And that maybe I've gone a little bit too far in a particular direction as an overreaction of what I didn't get from my dad. And I began to say to some men, as I would train them for their role in life, that we have to be careful because sometimes it's our lack of sensitivity to our daughters and how we need to be nurturing to them as well that creates the militant feminism that haunts them the rest of their lives. So I think men need to also understand how they impact the sexual development of daughters. And by every nurturing, appropriate way of responding to them, tells them who they are and affirms them and helps them to feel good about themselves physically.
The mounting, I call them attacks, on marriage and family life, mm-hmm. whether that's now the attempt to discard the DOMA Definition of Marriage Act, the promotion of same sex mm-hmm. Marriage. This is serious business, I think, and I don't think it bodes well for our society, for our culture, if this kind of thing continues. I know it's not specifically what we're talking about, but it's just another example of the interest that certain lobbies have in literally tearing down what we understand marriage and family life to be.
Exactly. And what's interesting is, you know, I mentioned textbooks earlier, but there was a blue ribbon panel that was assembled under Blankenhorn out of New York that looked at the textbooks on marriage and the family for universities and colleges all over the continental United States, to include Catholic colleges and universities. And we found a militant feminist bias against the traditional two-parent family, male and female. And that it was also interesting that the person usually saddled with the responsibility of teaching that first year course on marriage and the family was themselves a militant feminist. And so I think that bias really hurts the objectivity that would acknowledge just how important fathers are and how the traditional family is, why marriage matters to the next generation. Now, we're going to be doing the hard-nosed research demonstrating that there is some negative fallout from all of this, but now they are biding their time because, you know, we don't know. We don't yet know quantifiably, but we will. And once we know, it'll be like what we saw with fathering, a subtle turn, you know, of the bow of the ship toward fathers and toward traditional marriage and family.
I hope so. I can't get over the you know, what we know, for instance, about something like cohabitation.
Right.
The figures there, I don't know if it's making any difference to young people.
You know, they just, you know, it's frustrating, isn't it? I mean, if you go into the dentist, you'll see a poster, no doubt, on his or her wall that says, you don't have to floss your teeth, only the ones you want to keep. You know, so it's at what point do we get it that this is not helpful? This is not healthful. This is not just a religious question, right? This is not just Catholic. This is something that is sociologically a necessity.
Biologically, yes.
You know, so we're going to learn eventually, just like promiscuity brought us horrific diseases, right? You know, unquestionably, we know that AIDS is acquired. I mean, you don't just wake up one day and you have AIDS. You have to go out and acquire it like you purchase a car. And it's because of a promiscuous lifestyle. And so we can demonstrate it, but at what point do people say, well, there's the hard facts. When are we going to learn?
It's like smoking, I guess.
It is. It's the dilemma of human nature.
Although, after all these years, that seems to be working.
I mean, I can't believe commercials back in the 50s where we would show medical doctors on commercials smoking,
sure.
Saying, you know, this is a great thing, you know. I remember a little bit of Woody Allen, who had this futuristic film and was joking about cigarettes. Oh, why are you smoking? We're learning now it produces cancer. And he was joking. Of course, not true. You know, oh, yeah, we heard it's good for you now. Yeah. Well, hopefully that's not going to happen. But, yeah, at some point we learn, don't we, that this is not helpful for children or other living things.
That's right. Tell us, Michael, what is a real McCoy dad.
Yeah, the real McCoy versus the counterfeit. You know, it's a good way to discuss fathering because God is creator. We know that. God is creator. The Holy Trinity created us in God's image, and therefore we have the ability to create. We have the ability to procreate. Satan cannot create. He can only counterfeit. Isn't that interesting?
It's true. That is true.
And so when I'm talking about the real McCoy dad, I'm talking about what did God really intend for men to be if they are married and if he blesses them with children. Notice I didn't say if he chooses to have children.
Right.
You know, if you are capable biologically of having children, then it is already inherent in the family quote that you can therefore produce to the glory of God. And if he blesses you, then you procreate. You share in the creation. Well, the real McCoy dad is simply what God intends the male to be as father in that relationship. And the more that the father is nurturing, involved, aware, knows what's going on in the life of that child. You know, I often ask a father, you know, if you gave your son or daughter $5, do you know how they would spend it? You know, that simply, right? Simple things like that. Aware of who their friends are, getting over to the house where the friend spends a lot of time to meet the parents in that household, to know what's going on. These are the responsibilities of fathers. It's interesting that when you to really think about this in a biblical way in terms of the real McCoy dad, you know, we had Jesus who came and his first four miracles, think about it, when he came into the world, his first four miracles, he healed the blind, the deaf, those who could not speak, and the lame, right? Those are the four miracles, first four miracles of Jesus. And what's interesting, the area where he performed these miracles was where Jezebel cursed the land. And you have to remember that Jezebel usurped the authority of her husband to have her way and was very much against Elijah. And when we get into Malachi, we realize that in the power and spirit of Elijah, God will come to turn the hearts of the fathers toward their children. That's in the closing chapter of Malachi. And then in Luke chapter 1, verse 17, it says, he will come in the power and spirit of Elijah, talking about John the Baptist, to turn the hearts of the fathers toward their children. So there's a curse by Jezebel, and then there's a healing of the land that is wrought by Jesus. And so he heals the blind. Fathers can't see. They're not aware of the needs of their children. Fathers are deaf. They cannot hear the cries of their children for help. Fathers are lame. They cannot get to where their children need them to be, right? Fathers are mute. They can't say to their children, I love you. Now, what's also interesting, these are congenital diseases. Do you know what that means genetically?
Yeah.
These are passed on only by the father to the next generation. So Jesus is healing something congenital that has a profound spiritual healing. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so the real McCoy dad, he's going to see his children. He's going to hear their cries for help. He's going to be able to speak the language of love into their lives, even audibly, verbally. And he's going to be able to get to where his children need him to be.
And that's reflected in Scripture. But yeah, as you started to talk about it, it sounds like the real McCoy dad can be that, perhaps even if he's not a believer, not a Christian. I mean, is this something that...
Oh, yeah, I would agree. But I think it's best felt in experience within the context of Catholicism.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, yeah, where fathers understand that they are priests and they are prophets,
oh, sure,
to their families. Oh,
sure,
yeah.
Sure, sure. Well, Michael, we'll continue and actually conclude this conversation very shortly, but we'll take our final break right now.
ColoradoCatholicHerald.com is the website of the award-winning Colorado Catholic Herald newspaper. For the latest Catholic news, both at home and around the world, log on to ColoradoCatholicHerald.com. The Colorado Catholic Herald, bringing the Catholic world to you.
We're back now with Dr. Michael O'Donnell, and we're talking about his new book, What a Son Needs from His Dad, published by Bethany House. Michael, you want to tell our listeners where they can find that book? Is it in most religious or Catholic bookstores?
It is. And if it isn't, they can ask for it by name, What a Son Needs from His Dad, Bethany House Publishers. But it's on, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, ChristianBooks.com. But they also can go to my blog, which is on What a Son Needs from His Dad, all one word, .wordpress.com, and they can find all kinds of resources there for them.
Okay, very good. Now I want to ask you, Michael. This is our last segment, and in your book you write that much of what's involved in giving our sons what they need comes down to telling them what we think and feel.
Right, and I'm referencing there Thomas Lacona, who did a wonderful book, Raising Good Children, where he talks about teaching by telling. And the reason I bring that up in the book is research is showing a correlation between what a father says are his expectations for his children and the children actually growing up to embrace that lifestyle. If a father, for example, says verbally, sits down and says to the son and says to the daughter, I expect you as your father to remain chaste until you are in the bonds of holy matrimony, the research shows it going through the roof, that both the daughter and the son will abstain, much more so than if the mother alone says that to them.
What's it? Why?
You know, isn't that interesting? It could be one of the mysteries that are a part of our faith, you know, when it comes to the sacramental life. But it's just the way God designed men and women in the bonds of holy matrimony to be, to have that kind of impact. There's just something about hearing it from dad, knowing that that's dad's expectation, that has that kind of lasting and profound
effect. That's cause for optimism.
It is. But it is. And fathers listening to you right now need to heed it.
But again, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Everything that we see depicted or hear about relationships between especially adolescents and either parent is tell a kid what to do and the kid's going to do just the opposite. Not true from what you're saying.
Not true if the father is involved. It can't just be the mother saying it because they hear the mother all the time. But the voice of the father, the insistence of the father, the value that the children place on the father, not that they devalue the mother, don't misunderstand me, but that it's both and versus either or. Yeah.
Is it enough that a father simply say, this is what I expect of you? Or how important is it to fill that in?
It is about the relationship. If I'm developing a relationship from the time that they're very small and they know that I'm available, that I can be called out of myself in the act of hearing them, this gets back to the blessing versus the curse, you know, that I can see, that I can hear, that I can speak, that I can be where they need me to be, then when I speak to them about what I expect, it will have weight in their young lives. But if I don't have the relationship and if I think, well, I'll wait till they're grown and older to share with them the way I think and feel and believe. It will be too late. It really will be too late.
So if a father just injects himself into the life of a teenager almost for the first time and trying to lay down the law, it's not going to be very effective.
Not effective at all. Exactly. But if he's been there all along, tucking them in at night, reading to them, bedtime stories, helping them with daily chores. It's amazing how that becomes the foundation to transmit my values and mores.
I'm thinking of the fathers who may be listening to us right now and who are thinking, I don't know if I did such a good job of that when my kids were young. Now they're teenagers. Do I just throw up my arms now and say I blew it? Or is there any hope for retrieving?
There is hope.
Good. Tell us.
And the hope is go to them and have a one-on-one conversation with your children if they're adult or if they're in the throes of the teenage or adolescent experience. Say, I am realizing that you needed me far more than I understood. And part of the reason I didn't understand that is I gave you what my dad gave me. And I didn't understand that I really wanted more from my father. But my father gave me what his father gave him. So it's intergenerational. I want to break that intergenerational pathology. And I want to start by owning the fact that I didn't give you what you needed. And I want to ask for your forgiveness. And I want to do this because I don't want you to make the same mistakes. And so let's learn together. Let's start healing the relationship and thinking about what do you need as my son or daughter from me? And what do I need as your father from you? And it's never too late. I mean, that's the beautiful thing, right? In Catholicism, we say we're just one confession away of being restored, right?
That's right.
And
that's
the beauty of it.
There's an ad that I hear every once in a while on the radio. And it's the voice of a young girl, a teenage girl, mm-hmm. Appealing to her parents to talk to her about sex.
Yes.
I want to know what you think, because everybody else is talking to me. I need to know.
That's right.
Somebody out there knows the message to get across in that.
And if they have the relationship, again, it comes down to the relationship, then having that conversation will not be difficult, because it will be only one in a series of very difficult conversations versus waiting till that one moment. I'm going to talk about the birds and the bees. It's almost too late. But I also want to say to dads who are listening right now that the greatest gift they can give their child is to love their mother. So if they really want to model about human sexuality in the context of holy matrimony, it really needs to begin with, how do I treat my wife? How do I talk to her? And I think the civility has to be in evidence, the opening up the door, the treating her in a very respectful, commendable way. And that will then send the message to the children, don't ever disrespect your mother. You know, that there will be disciplinary consequences for that. But sometimes children are downright disrespectful to the mother because the father is. And they'll say, well, I don't do that in front of the children. They hear it.
Oh, sure.
They pick it up. They surely do. And that's why infidelity or anything like that is so destructive to the modeling that must take place for the children to grow up in honoring their mother.
I can imagine that could extend then to how these young men treat all women.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely,
which is why fathers need to understand the impact that they have not only on their sons but on their daughters, so that they are respectful to the daughter. We do research and we find that a father will often stop and hear what the son is saying, but often not extend the same courtesy to his daughter. He'll talk over her talking. And so that sends a clear message not only to the son that I'm more valued than my sister, but imagine to the sister herself. I'm not as valued as my brother. So fathers need to think about these dynamics and what they don't know. There's so much material now available than when you and I were in school. I mean, you've got the internet, and now we can use it as a good and productive tool. You know, you just Google in there, good parenting, and there are 1,000 articles available that are practical. But the one that I want to recommend,
not to mention your new book.
That's right. Yeah. What a Son Needs from His Dad, How a Man Prepares His Sons for Life. Yeah.
What is the hardest thing a father has to tell his son? What's hard? You're a father. What's hardest thing you had to tell your son?
Oh, I think it is difficult to talk about human sexuality.
The talk.
Yeah. But I, you know, what I began to learn, and I learned this really from my wife, is, you know, talk as frankly as they need you to communicate with them on a particular question, and be intelligent and mature about it, and don't use pet names. We don't need to go over that on the air. People know what I'm talking about. Call it what it is biologically. And so that they're used to coming to you and getting frank responses to frank questions, and don't give them more than their little minds can handle. There's the old joke, you know, the little boy, you know, "Daddy, where did I come from?" And father breaks out in a cold sweat and, you know, takes a gulp of water. And, well, you know, and he goes over the whole complicated process of reproduction. And the boy, you know, is just so perplexed. He says, "Well, Dad, Phil says he came from Chicago." So, you know, make sure you clarify what the boy or girl is asking. Yeah, you bet.
So that was the toughest thing for you. It probably is the toughest thing for most fathers.
I think it is for most dads. We want to evade that, but it's to our peril, obviously. Right. And, you know, just talk to other dads, you know. You know, don't do it as a group, you know.
Right.
Father to son, but find out what other fathers have done. And that's why the older men are to be in the lives of the younger men. You know, this is a biblical concept. I deal with this powerful Paul, timid Timothy. It's interesting that Timothy, we are told, as an apostle, had a spirit of timidity. And we find out that that was talk about the feminization of the church. He received the faith through grandmother, mother, son. Didn't come through his father, who was a Greek, we are told. So Paul does something interesting. He adopts him as a spiritual son, and he has him circumcised. Now, we know what Paul thought of circumcision, right? But he wanted to put him, Timothy, through a rite of passage. And then he wrote to Timothy, "Whenever you're feeling that spirit of timidity, remember when I and the elders laid our hands on you, fan into flame the gift you received." What was the gift? The healing of your masculine soul.
Isn't that powerful? It is. You know who used that text to preach on to about 25,000 young people in the Archdiocese of St. Louis, Pope John Paul II.
Is that right?
When he visited St. Louis, and his first event was to gather with young people.
Uh-huh.
That's the text.
Well, he really got it, didn't he?
That he used, yeah. And I must admit, I've stolen some things over and over again from that particular, especially at confirmation.
And I'm sure he doesn't mind because we all have the same teacher, right?
Exactly.
So,
exactly. You know, Michael, so much of what you said, it sounds so common sense. And
it does.
And yet, in some ways, as a society, as a culture, we've blown it. But it's not without hope. And
that's right.
A lot of this could be mended if we take these kinds of relationships seriously. But right now, what I have to take seriously is the fact that we're coming to the end of our time together. So I want to thank you, Dr. Michael O'Donnell, author of What a Son Needs from His Dad, and also author of the monthly column in our Colorado Catholic Herald, Family Matters, so people can keep up with you even on a regular basis. Thanks so much for being with us. We usually end our programs with a prayer that more often than not I offer, but I know that you've brought with me a prayer. Is it in your book?
It's in my book,
yeah.
And it's an adaptation of Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 to 4.
Why don't you give us our closing prayer,
okay,
then?
Okay, Your Excellency. O Lord, may their sons never forget your teachings. May their hearts keep your commandments. Then, Lord, you will give many more days and years to their lives, and you will add your peace. May kindness and truth never leave them, Lord. May they bind them about their necks and write them on their hearts. Then, Lord, you will give them favor and a good reputation, both with you and with man, and the blessing of God Almighty.
And may Almighty God bless all of our listeners, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents on the Catholic Radio Network. Join us each week as Bishop Michael Sheridan of the Diocese of Colorado Springs discusses topics relevant to your life and your faith. Bishop Sheridan Presents is a production of the Catholic Radio Network and the Diocese of Colorado Springs. If there is a topic that you'd like to hear covered by Bishop Sheridan Presents, please call the Catholic Radio Network at 970-669-8000. Thanks again for listening to Bishop Sheridan Presents, brought to you by the Colorado Catholic Herald, the official newspaper of the Diocese of Colorado Springs.
The Colorado Catholic Herald is now on Twitter. The Colorado Catholic Herald, your primary source of news and events from around the diocese, is now on the social media platform of Twitter. Get advance notice of upcoming headlines, breaking news, and special event coverage. Our handle is the @ CCHERALD. That's @CC Herald. So join us on Twitter.